Good mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, each year, Canine Companions provides hundreds of service dogs at no cost to assist individuals with disabilities. But have you ever wondered where those canines come from? Also this morning, Americans will wager nearly $3 billion on college basketball over the next 2 weeks. It's all in good fun until it isn't. In case you missed it, why are automakers and the government forging ahead with the forced transition to electric vehicles when it seems obvious that consumers aren't ready? And we have another collection of yummy and easy-to-make recipes from Kyra's Kitchen. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Friday, March 22nd, 2024. Crazy tournament already, and after the first day, there are only like 2,000 brackets out of the 20-some-odd million that were filled out on the ESPN website. There are like less than 2,000 that are perfect. I don't know who picked Oakland over Kentucky, but apparently a couple thousand people did, and they have perfect brackets, but everybody else busted. Good mornings to you. It is Friday, March 22nd, the 82nd day of 2024, 284 days remaining in the year. By the way, the women's tournament is underway. Lady Buckeyes will play today. And the tournament, the NCAA women's tournament, is being played the early rounds in Columbus. And as a matter of fact, I think the Buckeyes actually play in Columbus today. That plus the Buckeye men in the NIT, where they play at home in the early rounds, is the way that tournament is structured. They don't have neutral site games. So with all of those games being played in Columbus this weekend, the local economic people, tourism people in Columbus say that it is going to provide a big economic boost to Central Ohio. The basketball events will generate around $3 million in visitor spending, according to tourism officials there. So that's no small chunk of change. And of course, the women's NCAA finals are going to be in Cleveland this year. So some nice economic stimulus there for the Buckeye State with the tournaments. Although, with respect to Columbus, fans who are coming in going to find that they may be breathing heavily, not because of the excitement on the court, but because Columbus, once again, has the worst air in the U.S., for the second year in a row, a Swiss air pollution technology company has named Columbus the most polluted major U.S. city. Second year in a row. The IQ Air World Air Report lists the Ohio State Capitol as the worst in the nation when it comes to airborne contaminants for 2023. And you think, really? Above like L.A. and, you know, I mean, L.A. is one of the first cities you think of when you think of air pollution. But no, Columbus. Brandy Whetstone with the Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission says the report can be somewhat misleading because the study does note that some of the pollution last year was due to the massive Canadian wildfires that spread residual smoke into the Buckeye State last year. And they say the Columbus area has seen an overall air quality improvement trend over the past three decades, but for the second year in a row, worst air quality in the country, in the state of Ohio. That is wild. Would not have guessed that. By the way, speaking of March Madness, in what is maybe the least surprising survey regarding March Madness that I have ever seen, 97%, it says here, 97% of college basketball fans snack while watching the games. Who actually had to put out a survey to learn this? 97% of college basketball fans snack while watching the games. 58% of those say they eat more food during the tournament than during the rest of college basketball season. The Frank's Red Hot survey of 2,000 basketball fans also found that 24% of fans, 1 in 4, drown their sorrows in snacks when their favorite team loses. And when it comes to spicy stuff, 27% of fans prefer a hot level in their food. They want a little kick in their snacks. Must-have condiments include hot sauce, buffalo sauce, sriracha, and hot honey. So, hot honey. So, in the least surprising poll results ever, 97% of college basketball fans snack during the games. I don't want to meet the 3% who don't. I mean, if you don't, something's wrong with you. You're just weird. This was kind of interesting. Among the first things you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day, this is certainly interesting and buzzworthy. Apparently, some scientists are considering building a railroad on the moon. A railroad on the moon. And the U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency is backing this idea. They think this is a great idea. They are planning a network of rails that could transport people and supplies on the lunar surface. The aerospace company Northrop Grumman could bring the concept to life. Apparently, they did a study on how to best create an economy on the moon, because there's been talk of colonizing the moon at some point in the future. And they say the best way to create an economy on the moon could include mining and robotics. And the program manager for the U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, Michael Nyack, is the program manager, saying, "We're excited to get started. We're going to build a railroad on the moon." Here's the thing, and this is the question with all of this. How do you get the materials there? I mean, you're going to build a spacecraft that can transport, you know, steel rails in massive amounts to the moon? Are you going to build a spacecraft that can take front end loaders and, you know, all of the heavy machinery that it will take to build railroads on the moon? How are you going to get all of the equipment there? That's what I want to know. Anyway, they say they can do it. So, I guess we'll find out. And lastly this morning, among the first things you need to know today to get your day started. Speaking of sports, we'll set aside basketball for a moment. The NFL's competition committee is going to be meeting. Are they meeting now, or are they going to be meeting in the next few weeks? I don't know exactly the timeline on this, but apparently there is a report here that the NFL's competition committee is hoping to make some rule changes. Yesterday, the committee proposed a revamped kickoff in addition to a rule that would prohibit the hip drop tackling technique. The alignment used in the proposed kickoff change would resemble what was used in the XFL during previous seasons. The kicker would continue to kick from the 35-yard line, but the other 10 players would line up at the receiving team's 40-yard line. So it'd be a staggered line for the defenders. At least 9 members of the return team would line up in a setup zone between the 35 and the 30. And no one other than the kicker and returners can move at all until the ball hits the ground or touches a player inside the landing zone. So the idea, of course, is to make kickoffs safer. That's the idea. You don't want people getting injured. And so they continue to look at different ways of, and obviously that would pretty much eliminate the onside kick, right? I mean, if the other team has to line up so far away from the kicker and, you know, all of that, and nobody can move until the ball hits the ground. So if you're going to do this, then you've got to figure out some way to address the onside kick. And the hip drop tackling technique, that's long been criticized for its propensity to cause injuries. And so they're looking at eliminating that. And critics, once again, are shouting, well, you may as well make it flag football. Well, if that's what it takes to keep the players safe and keep them from serious injury and getting killed, maybe eventually that's what they will do. Who knows? But anyway, there you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Friday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather, mostly cloudy today, a high around 50, a chance of rain or snow tonight, a low around 30. Two people were arrested and booked at the Seneca County Jail after leading deputies on a high-speed pursuit. Upon initially stopping the vehicle and speaking with the occupants, the subject attempted to provide false identifying information to avoid apprehension. And while the deputy continued to investigate, that's when the driver sped off and a vehicle pursuit ensued. The pursuit covered several townships in the southern portion of Seneca County, and the vehicle eventually stopped in Wyandotte County, and the 44-year-old driver from Sycamore was taken into custody. A 39-year-old from Sycamore who was previously let out of the vehicle was also arrested. Get more on the pursuit in this story on our website. A proclamation signed by the governor designates March as Problem Gambling Awareness Month.
According to officials from Ohio for Responsible Gambling, calls to Ohio's problem gambling line increased by 55% in the first year of legalized sports betting in Ohio. In state fiscal year 2023, more than 67,000 Ohioans were screened for gambling disorder and more than 1,100 received clinical care. I'm Amy Steigerwald.
The Children's Mentoring Connections Bowling for Kids fundraiser is this weekend, and since the area is about to experience a total solar eclipse, there's a twist on the event this year.
Our twist on that is to have glow bowling this year. And so we are going to be bowling under the black lights. So we have special t-shirts that we're going to have. T-shirt sponsor is Marathon this year. And so we're going to have neon t-shirts.
And Stacy Shaw says a lane has been donated to allow for any mentor-mentee match, past or present, to bowl together. Learn more about the Bowling for Kids fundraiser in this story on our website. The Tiffin Police Department has a new officer. Officer Trent Shoemaker was sworn in. He brings with him extensive law enforcement experience gained from serving at the Wyandotte County Sheriff's Office, the Findlay Police Department, as well as his military law enforcement career. See pictures of the swearing-in ceremony and the story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news online anytime at WFIN.com.
You may have heard of this nonprofit organization before. Certainly you're familiar with the concept. Canine Companions enhances the lives of people with disabilities by providing them with a service dog, and they do so at no cost. But have you ever wondered where those dogs come from? Well, volunteers help build the foundation for these service animals by caring for the puppies that will eventually become the service dogs themselves. Joining us this morning is James Dern. He is director of their puppy program. First of all, James, tell us a little bit more about the Canine Companions organization here.
Good morning. Thank you. Yes, Canine Companions is the largest service dog provider in the United States. We've been around since 1975, and we have placed over 8,000 dogs.
Wow.
With adults, children, and veterans with disabilities.
So who are the volunteer puppy raisers, and why are they important in this larger scheme of the program?
Well, our volunteer puppy raisers are truly the backbone of our organization. They provide all of the early training and socialization, as well as the early health care that our puppies need to grow up to be confident, healthy, and highly skilled dogs to provide independence to our clients. And they're an absolutely wonderful, passionate group of people.
It stands to reason that the care that these puppies will get in that first year to 18 months can make a huge difference in the success rate of their training from that point forward and their ability to have that positive impact.
Yes, absolutely. You know, our volunteer puppy raisers learn all about how our dogs need to behave in public. Mm-hmm. We want to produce a dog that doesn't get too distracted by other dogs that may be walking by or by food on the floor. And so that takes work. And our puppy raisers practice a lot of different exercises. They'll, you know, drop food on the floor and, you know, keep the puppies focused on them instead of going for the food. So there's a lot of different games and sort of interactions that we've designed to help our puppy raisers prepare these dogs to be successful.
And that in addition to all of the regular training that goes along with taking a puppy into your home, I'm thinking specifically about housebreaking a dog.
Right. Yeah, that's a big part of it, of course.
Absolutely.
You know, we use Labradors and Goldens who tend to, to housebreak really easily. Mm-hmm. So, and using a crate is a big part of that.
Right.
But house manners and doing things like not jumping on the couch or being under your feet when you're trying to cook dinner.
Yeah.
All of those things are really important to the success of our dog.
And again, the types of things that you would be doing with any family pet. So I think this is so cool because I just think, imagine being part of that journey and bringing this vital assistant to a child or an adult who needs it. So what does it take to raise a puppy to be a highly trained service dog? Who can do this?
Yeah, well, you know, anybody that wants to help other people and help them gain more independence, as well as has a passion for dogs, can be a puppy raiser. We provide all of the education that they need to help these dogs be successful. And, and if they are willing to bring the puppy back for professional training when the dog's about 18 months old, please come and join us. Our puppy raisers have been, yeah.
No, I was going to say, I would imagine that maybe sometimes is the most difficult part about that is raising them to that point and then having to take them back. But knowing the reason that you're taking them back and what they are in for moving forward makes that a little bit easier.
You know, I can't tell you, I am a puppy raiser myself, and going through this process with the focus of the dog going on in a career of service has been the focus the entire time. And having the opportunity to then hand over the leash to one of the clients at Canine Companions and see the dog go on to help this person and make an impact in their lives or even in their community is incredibly fulfilling.
Yeah.
So our volunteer puppy raisers also raise puppy after puppy. They get hooked, and having another puppy in the wings to come replace the other one can really ease some of that heartbreak.
I would imagine it becomes a pretty easy sell. Are there certain individuals or families that you are looking for specifically? I mean, are there certain, you know, like I said, families versus individuals, or those with homes versus apartments, or, you know, are there certain types of people that you're looking for in terms of the most qualified to do this?
You know, anybody that is willing to raise a puppy, we would love to have them come join us. We have an incredibly wide range of people that have joined our organization through puppy raising. That includes, you know, young people in high school or college to professionals and retired people, anybody that has a passion for dogs and helping people is welcome to come join us.
So the big question, how do people get involved? Where can we get more information and perhaps sign up if someone is interested in becoming involved in this?
Absolutely. They can go to our website at canine.org/raise and get more information about the program and even start their application to be a puppy raiser.
Again, James Dern is director of the puppy program for Canine Companions. James, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the madness of March is well underway, and over the next couple of weeks, Americans will collectively wager the better part of $3 billion on college basketball games, that according to the American Gambling Association. Thanks to a combination of legalized sports wagering in a growing number of states and the miracles of modern technology, it is as simple as tapping your smartphone. CNET managing editor and personal finance reporter Nick Wolny has been looking into this and joins us this morning. I know, Nick, for many people, this is all in good fun, and the last thing that we're trying to do is spoil it. But you say there is a case to be made that it has become just a little too easy to bet on the games.
Yeah, well, one of the big things that's come up and that a lot of people are concerned about regarding gambling is how the tech can better enable gambling addiction. You know, there's really two factors to addiction development. One of them is speed and the other is frequency. And so when this act was repealed in 2018, to allow people to gamble on their phones in more states and things like that, it's made it really, really easy to just gamble on the go. You know, you can gamble from this computer that's in your pocket 24 right. hours a day, 7 days a week, you know? And so I think that actually brings up a really great point, Chris, where, you know, for many people, like gambling, there's an entertainment component to it. It's meant to be fun. It's meant to be entertaining. Often it's meant to be social. Yeah. And now that we have this digitized version of it, that is not just betting on a game, but specifically betting within a game, betting on whether someone's going to make the free throw, betting on whether someone's going to make the field goal. Mm. You know, it's just this frequency has gone way up. This speed has gone way up. It's just really greasing the wheel for people who might be susceptible to more of those addictive behaviors to begin to stumble and fall into that, for particularly for men under the age of 35, which is the majority of people who end up encountering smartphone gambling addiction challenges. Yeah,
not a coincidence there. It is fascinating. I mean, when you look at the tech that is driving this, it is fascinating how quickly this has evolved from something that was done in smoke-filled bars with bookies to a point-and-click proposition that is really driving the entire industry, these smartphone apps. And in fact, it's the online platforms and the smartphone apps that pushed this issue to get sports wagering outside of Las Vegas legalized in the first place. I mean, one could not exist without the other right now.
Right. And particularly with online gambling, desktop-based gambling, another thing that's come up is the use of VPNs, you know, to bypass limits. And so if someone who's 16, 17 years old wants to gamble online, they just need to get a VPN and then they can go to, you know, they usually can't go to one in the States because the operators in the States have wised up. If you try to log in with a VPN on one of those sites or on your phone, you'll likely get blocked or banned. But the same is not necessarily true for these international websites. And so, you know, if a teenager wanted to get involved and start gambling and they know their way around a VPN, then they can actually do it. And so it's this entertainment that was not really intended for young people, but now through the lens of technology, young people are able to participate in much more.
For those that don't know, VPN is short for virtual private network, which is a way by which you can mask who you really are, where you really are, and so on. And really that drives home the point that I wanted to ask you about. You combine the technology that is driving this and the fact that young people are particularly comfortable with technology. It's native to them. It's easy to see why, especially for young people, this becomes a very big concern.
Yeah, and it's also something that they just perhaps haven't had a lot of experience with. You know, young people have not had many years of busting their butt to make that that money. You know what I mean? And right. So it can be really tempting, even in particular. You know, I just got off the phone with someone for the story I'm working on for you know, specifically sports betting and online gambling. And something he would talk about is, you know, if you're gambling over the weekend, the operators, when you fill up your account, they'll just go off of what your bank balance was on Friday, you know, and if someone's used up their whole bank balance, you know, they'll keep depositing and the operator will let them do it. You know, they're trying to dig themselves out of that hole, and many times they'll end up just digging themselves in deeper and deeper. And so we're just raising awareness of that going into March Madness, because it is the, you know, it actually is the biggest sports betting event of the year.
Right.
$2.72 billion. That's about double what was spent on the Super Bowl. For reference there. And a big part of that is just the sheer volume. There's 134 games. If you combine the men's tournament and the women's tournament, 134 games in just under 3 weeks. And, you know, the AGA also commented that they're seeing about a 250% year-over-year increase in betting on the women's tournament. In particular, we were joking, we were calling it the Caitlin Clark effect, right? You know, people following Iowa really closely. You know, she's breaking records left and right and all this stuff. But even besides that, just the ubiquity of all of it, and then again to have your phone to be able to get push notifications on your phone, you know she's getting ready to play, or a certain team is getting ready to play. Do you want to bet? Do you want to get in on this?
Yeah.
And it's not the sitting around chatting with your buddies. It's you hanging out a little longer in the bathroom stalls, you know, while you're at work, so that you can place the bet, or you're commuting home and you're waiting at a train, you know, and so you've got 5 minutes to kill, and you're like, oh my gosh, I could place the bet right now. You know, it's awfully easy to place that bet, and more often than not, it starts to get people in trouble just because of that speed and frequency perspective.
You bring up a couple of good points. Obviously, Caitlin Clark has been a huge boost to TV ratings, but also to gambling, because all of a sudden there's this whole second tournament that people can wager on. And you mentioned the push notifications and all of that, the things that are designed within the app to suck people back in. These apps, they have algorithms. I mean, just like social media, they're designed to reel you in and keep you playing.
And these apps also have AI. You know, that's important for people to be aware of as well. Many of the operators have implemented AI technology in various ways just to really customize that experience. I mean, AI is awfully nice for, you know, making recommendations on other things, you know, chatbots and whatnot. But again, just adding this acceleration to the experience, making it very, very custom, making it very bespoke. And I think also another factor, Chris, is that more states are legalizing the operators because it's a huge cash grab.
Sure.
For states, you know, and as some of these states are in considerable deficits, you know, it's not unusual to charge a 10%, 12% tax on every transaction with an operator that's operating in state. And so that creates some challenges where, you know, representatives have to weigh the fact that they have to balance these sometimes, you know, enormous deficits or, you know, state level budgets versus people's well-being, you know, and just how available do we really make that? We did have a little bit of a pullback last year, you know, for a couple of years there was advertising on college campuses. And so people really had some question marks over their head about that. It's like, okay, the majority of the people in this football stadium are under 21 right now. You know, why do we have so many ads for the online gambling or direct marketing specifically to college students? And so while that's been pulled back, the AGA has regulated that a little more tightly as of this year. It's still very, very easy for young people to get involved with that. And if they're not careful, again, just the frequency of it all can make it really easy to lose a lot of money really quickly.
So as you are digging into this for your reporting at CNET, do there need to be more guardrails here? I mean, can things continue the way they are, or are we headed for a reckoning?
I mean, we'll ultimately have to see. I think it will take, you know, hopefully with what we're achieving with reporting and just raising awareness, raising congressional awareness as well, you know, of what the potential impact of these different tools can be. It's a form of entertainment for a lot of people. And, you know, if you don't have a gambling problem, then gambling can be pretty fun. You know, it's when you become susceptible to, you know, gambling a lot or gambling money that you don't have is when it starts to veer into problem territory. And so we'll ultimately start to see, I think, as we start to tell people's stories. I also know that at least one U.S. representative has introduced a bill that would ban sports betting on smartphones. I think that bill is going to have quite the uphill battle, considering how much cash this generates.
Right.
But, you know, like many other things, I think a good parallel might be something like social media, is that now there's a little bit more attention being paid to regulation, or specifically, what can we do once we had all these stories stories start to come out about how it can be affecting young people's mental health, how it can be contributing to deteriorating mental health in general. A lot of it is just starting to really collect that data. I don't think we're near a reckoning anytime soon. We're only 6 years into this this sports betting ban being overturned on the federal level. So I think we're still at an up for a while. We've got more states who are likely going to legalize it more broadly. But I think it's just making sure we're telling people stories around along the way and making sure that people are aware of what the risks are. It's good to have a little bit of fun. But if you're starting to, you know, that's what the source just said half an hour ago. He's like, I just wasn't having any fun anymore. You know, once it crosses into that territory, that's when you want to start to seek out help.
Yeah. You know that you're in trouble. NCAA basketball tournament, the single biggest sports wagering event of the year. As you mentioned, it can be exciting, but can also be dangerous. CNET managing editor and personal finance reporter Nick Wolny with us this morning. Nick, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So on Wednesday of this week, the Environmental Protection Agency finally unveiled their new standards for vehicle emissions that had been long discussed and debated. The standards will ultimately pressure the industry into putting more electric vehicles in Americans' driveways and garages. EPA Administrator Michael Regan said in a statement, and I'm quoting, "With transportation the largest source of U.S. climate emissions, these strongest ever pollution standards for cars solidify America's leadership in building a clean transportation future and creating good-paying American jobs, all while advancing President Biden's historic climate agenda." The president pointed out, saying, 3 years ago, I set an ambitious target that half of all new cars and trucks sold in 2030 would be zero emission. So these goals would, according to the EPA, reduce U.S. greenhouse gas emissions by 7.2 billion metric tons through 2055. It's about four times the total emissions of transportation of the transportation sector as of 2021. And these new standards will impact newly manufactured cars and trucks from model years 2027 through 2032. Now, critics say that this amounts to a de facto ban on internal combustion engines, on gas-powered cars. And that is not entirely accurate. That's a bit of hyperbole. The EPA doesn't have the authority to ban anything. And they point out that manufacturers will have multiple pathways to compliance using a combination of battery electric vehicles, plug-in hybrids, traditional hybrids, and improved internal combustion engines. But the fact is that absent some major technological breakthrough in gas-powered engines, the only way to comply with these new standards is to move more Americans to electrically powered vehicles, at least hybrids or fully electric vehicles. And as we were discussing these rules, because these have been these rules have been in the works for quite a while, and there were, you know, rumors or discussions about how strict they would be some weeks ago, we were talking about this and we asked the question, why are automakers and the government forging ahead when it seems obvious that consumers aren't ready? Sales of electric vehicles have precipitously dropped off in recent years. And we asked industry veteran James Bell to dispel some of the persistent misunderstandings about electric vehicles and their place in our automotive future. Why is there such a push to EVs when it seems as though the public just isn't there yet?
It's not dissimilar from the transition from horse-drawn carriages to gasoline-powered vehicles 100-plus years ago. We are living through a transitional time. We humans are often not good at transitional times. And this is not going to be a straight, smooth road. This is going to be bumpy. This is going to have curves. But the point is, and I'm going to use a bad electrification cliche here, the switch has been flipped. Yeah. And so, you know, we're not, electric vehicles are not going to go away. The investment of them in them is not going to go away. the industry is moving towards a space where emissions must be reduced, and that's on a global basis from Asia to Europe to America. You know, obviously this is a global issue. And how do you increase your fuel efficiency standards? You don't use fuel. So we are in a transitional time. It won't be simple. It won't be a straight line up, but it is going up and it's going to happen.
So what is the first thing that consumers need to know about electric vehicles? Is range anxiety still the biggest hurdle? Is that the biggest question you get from consumers?
I think we're in a bit of a transition phase from range anxiety to charging infrastructure anxiety. The vehicles today, over 300 miles on a charge. Average American drives about 28, 30 miles per day. I'm not good at math, but that tells me right there that I've got more than enough power to drive for a better part of a week, if not longer.
Yeah.
So, but I do think so. We're moving away from range anxiety into infrastructure anxiety, and that's where things are really going to get interesting.
Let me ask you about a couple of things that I know are that you hear quite often that are misperceptions. There are the questions about the inefficiency of the batteries in the wintertime affecting range and affecting the quality of the charge. And that's not necessarily, some of that is not necessarily a misperception, but that whole question of what if my battery dies and leaves me stranded in the snow?
Yeah, a couple things at play. First off, all electric vehicles, they have something that's called preconditioning the battery. Basically, keeping them a little bit, using some of the power, a very small amount, to kind of keep the fluids that surround the batteries to keep them happy, keep them warm. You know, just from a physical perspective, yes, you're going to have, in cold weather situations because of battery chemistries today, some negative impact. But there's ways to mitigate that. In the case of all Kia vehicles, our vehicles come with something called an electric heat pump, which basically not only provides electric powered heat for the cabin of the vehicle to keep occupants comfortable, but then also to make that whole electric powertrain as efficient as possible.
Yeah.
So again, you know, we're in a transitional phase. You know, I'm sure those horse-drawn carriages didn't love it in the cold either.
And so good point.
Things will work their way out.
The other,
it's going to happen.
The other big question that I always hear from skeptics, I'm sure you do too. What about battery degradation over time? I have to replace my phone every couple of years because the battery holds less and less of a charge, and an electric vehicle is like 30 or 40 times more expensive than my phone.
Two things. Number one, huge warranties on electric powertrains. In the case of a Kia vehicle, it's over 150,000 miles just on the electric powertrain itself. So, you know, we basically bear that burden. Secondly, the computing technology that goes into managing the power as it's going in, as you're charging the battery, and also as you're using it to drive down the road is much more advanced. You mentioned cell phones. The problem and why we have degradation in our cell phone batteries is, well, what do? We come home at night, we put on the charge, and it fills up overnight, and it stays filled overnight, and then we take it off the charge, and we run it down to the bottom, and then we charge at the top again. Batteries hate that life. They like to be somewhere in the middle. And with electric vehicles, we have, you know, obviously much more advanced computing power that you can put into a car, but you can't put into a phone, and manage that power input and output much more comfortably. In fact, on my electric vehicle, I have it set up so it will, you know, manage my charging in a way that maximizes battery life. So there's, between the knowing how batteries work their best and having this these extended warranties from the manufacturers, we just don't see that as a problem. And from a durability perspective, essentially, you know, batteries, the only thing that can go wrong is if there might be some little manufacturing mishap. Maybe, you know, the human who built the battery maybe, you know, introduced some sort of contaminant or something.
Yeah.
Yes, there are issues. But again, that's where the warranty kicks in.
Yeah, bottom line, those batteries are designed to outlast the car itself in most cases. Again, James Bell with an EV 101 course for us this morning. James, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you.
Part of our conversation back at the end of February, we were talking about this, anticipating these new EPA emissions regulations that were introduced formally earlier this week. And if you want to hear our complete conversation with James, check out the Good Mornings podcast edition. You'll have to go back to February 29th was the date that we had him on the program, and we talked quite a bit about some of the persistent myths of electric vehicles and some of the hurdles that they still need to overcome. But it is amazing the incredible advancements in technology that make electric vehicles viable for a much larger segment of the driving public. Now it's just convincing the American people that that's the case. And you can learn more about all of this amazing technology of EVs at our webpage. We've got it linked up at goodmornings.net. It is state championship weekend for Ohio high school basketball. And at 24-3 on the year, Ottawa Glandorf returns to the Final Four for its fourth straight year, their fourth straight year, seeking their fourth state title, their first since 2013. It's been quite a run for the Titans, with three consecutive WBL titles and a 94-15 record over the past four seasons. They are led by this year's Mr. Basketball, senior Colin White. I thought this was kind of interesting. He is only one of two players in Ohio high school state history to start in four straight state tournaments. You know who the other one was? LeBron James. So that's pretty good company right there for young Mr. White. And earlier this week, preview tonight's semifinal matchup, Kahuna from our sister station 106.3 The Fox spoke to head coach Tyson McLaughlin about the chance to finally win a championship.
I've got to believe that it's been a pretty fun week at the school this week.
Yeah, it really has. The halls are exciting. The people are full of energy, and we're looking forward to a hopefully great weekend.
Is this a hard week to be a head basketball coach?
It is, just from the coaching standpoint. There's just a lot of additional responsibilities that come with the state tournament between the media and just different engagements that you have to take care of. It's a different routine, but fortunately for us, we're kind of familiar with this process and really helps as far as our coaching staff, as far as how we can prepare and differentiate some of these things.
You guys tip off at 5:15, I believe. So what will you do, let's say, starting from when you get there, what all happens?
Well, we're staying the night, so we'll wake up, we'll have breakfast, and then we'll go to Centerville High School, and we'll have a walkthrough and just get our guys out of the hotel and get us moving. Just last-minute kind of preparation. We'll come back and have food in at the hotel, have a big lunch, later lunch than normal, with the game being at 5:15. We'll eat around 1 o'clock, and then let the guys go back to the hotel room, kind of relax, chill out, and then we'll head to UD probably about 3 o'clock. And then there's a couple different things. Got to get a team picture, things like that. And then we just kind of try to get our minds right. Try to keep it as normal as possible. Kind of treat it as a Saturday game. Typically, we have shoot-arounds in the morning, and then they go home and kind of hang out and get off their feet and come back ready to go.
How's your stomach? Are you able to eat a good meal, or are you too nervous to chow down?
Lunchtime is going to be fine. There wouldn't be it. If it was a late game, I don't know. There wouldn't be anything past lunch, I don't think.
And probably no caffeine, I'm guessing.
No, I'm staying away from that. I did that last week, and I gave up pop, and then I thought I needed like an energy drink last week, and I thought I was going to bounce off the wall. So that is a no-no this week.
The big thing is have fun, and I know you've had that opportunity as a coach in the past. It's a great time for the kids, and we wish you the best of luck, and more importantly, have some fun.
Hey, absolutely. And once again, I appreciate all the support that you guys give us. And Titan Nation's unlike any other. And I know the blue and gold is going to be there. And, you know, it's greatly appreciated.
Again, Ottawa Glandorf in their fourth Final Four in as many years. Hopefully they'll be able to seal the deal this time around. They will play Harvest Prep tonight Airtime is 5 o'clock, tip-off 5:15 on 106.3 The Fox and at 106.3thefox.com.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
This is how you know that you're having a bad day. I mean, this is, you know you're having a bad day if something like this happens to you. A woman who couldn't make it to the funeral of a friend because I don't know what the full story is. Friend passed away. She couldn't make it. Maybe she was lived too far away or had something else going on. So anyway, she couldn't make it to the funeral. Started watching it on Zoom because in the 21st century, we Zoom everything for people who can't be there in person. This funeral was on Zoom. Ended up, though, she was the main attraction. Instead of the funeral, she was the main attraction. According to a report in the Daily Mail, the woman didn't realize her camera was on, stripped completely naked in full view of other remote mourners. Later, when she, I guess she couldn't make it to the funeral on time. She was late getting ready or something. So she was getting dressed to attend the wake afterwards. When she showed up at the church, she was totally unaware that she had, you know, been the star of the show. And adding insult to injury, footage of the incident has gone viral after being repeatedly shared online itself. So that's how you know you're having a bad day. You strip naked during an online funeral and then show up for the wake. Whoo. As long as something like that doesn't happen to you today, no matter what else happens, you know that your day has not been all that bad. It could definitely be worse. My goodness. Crazy story. Some of the other broken news this morning. Actually, kind of a light day for the broken news. Yesterday, we had a ton of broken news. Had all kinds of it. And broken news coming out of our ears today. Lighter stuff. Did you hear the story out of Texas in the Houston area about the Little Rascals bank robbery gang? Three boys, all between the ages of 11 and 16, were taken into custody in connection with a bank robbery of a Houston area Wells Fargo location. Authorities say the boys walked into the bank, gave the teller a threatening note. They did not show a weapon, but they handed over a threatening note. The bank employee tripped the silent alarm, and the cops showed up, took them into custody. The boys have been charged with robbery by threat. Authorities did not say if any cash was taken, or if it was, whether they recovered the money that may or may not have been stolen. They're calling it the Little Rascals Gang because of the ages. 11 to 16. Wow. That's wild. Homeless man in Los Angeles is in custody after hijacking a city bus using a BB gun. Authorities say that he was the last person on the bus and approached the driver on Wednesday night, ordered the driver to travel to multiple locations, hitting a number of vehicles along the way. As the bus neared the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in L.A., the suspect grabbed the wheel and caused the bus to slam several cars and crash through a wall into the hotel, into the Ritz-Carlton. The whole thing went on for about 2.5 miles. The suspect then fled the scene on foot, but was quickly detained by officers.
Wow.
Bus in the lobby of the Ritz-Carlton in L.A. Crazy. This is what happens when we turn our economy over to foreign interests. There have been stories about concerns about Chinese influence in the ag industry. This is what it could lead to. Two commercial farms, Asian-owned commercial farms, are trying to make snake meat a popular protein in Americans' diet. Will you have the chicken, the beef, or the python? The python. They want to raise pythons for meat. Apparently, growing pythons is very efficient when compared to animals like chicken and cows. It's a lot easier to raise pythons, I guess. In terms of food and protein conversion ratios, pythons outperform all other mainstream agricultural species studied to date, according to Dr. Daniel Notish. Pythons outperform all other mainstream agricultural species in terms of protein conversion ratios. Snake meat, already very popular in China and Southeast Asia, and in Hong Kong, Pizza Hut actually offers snake meat as a topping on their pizza pies. It's just wrong. It's just wrong. I know there are people who do, especially out west. They eat snakes. They trap, kill, and eat snakes. But, you know, rattlesnake meat and all of that. But I don't know. I just don't know if I could walk into a fast food joint and order a python burger. I just don't know that I can. This is what happens when we turn our agriculture industry over to foreign interests. Things like python meat on the menu. And finally, in the broken news this morning, this is a crazy story. Out of Canada, Chris Stewart lives in Kelowna, British Columbia. I think that's how you pronounce it. Kelowna, K-E-L-O-W-N-A. It's not really important. Anyway, he lives in British Columbia. His five-year-old cat named Bear recently passed away. He was so distraught over the passing of his beloved cat that he had the feline cloned. But as Chris quickly learned, the process was not easy and not cheap. Cloning an animal involves putting its DNA into an embryo, which is later transferred to a surrogate, in this case another cat, who carries and births the babies. Carrie Bowman, a bioethicist who works at the University of Toronto, tells the CBC in this report, "I felt like there was more living that needed to be done." Mr. Stewart tells the CBC, rather, "I just felt like there was more living that needed to be done by my beloved Bear." Bear, the name of the cat, of course. So Chris sent Bear's DNA to Viagen, a Texas-based pet cloning company. Now, here's the thing. Unfortunately, fewer than 5% of cloned animals survive birth. And in Chris Stewart's case, 4 failed attempts, and $50,000 later, Bear, and Honey Bear were born. So the clones of the original cat, Bear, and Honey Bear now. Stewart tells the CBC that he's thrilled that the kittens are showing some similarities to his original beloved cat. However, Dr. Bowman, the bioethicist we mentioned earlier, says although they share DNA, clones are never exactly the same as the original animal. In some cases, people have found that their cloned pets do not have a similar disposition to the original. I don't know what caught my eye on this story. Can you imagine spending $50,000 to clone your cat? I think I'd just go out and get another cat. You know, that's just go get another cat. It's not like there's a shortage of them. And there's a company that actually specializes in cloning pets. Who knew? There you go. Some of the odd and unusual headlines in today's broken news report. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
Did you know more than 80 million Americans depend on AM radio for their news, traffic, weather, sports, and a community connection? AM radio is the backbone of the emergency alert system, keeping Americans safe in dangerous times. This is News Director Matt Demchek. AM 1330 WFIN is here to serve you, and we take seriously our commitment to our listeners. We would love to hear what you value most about AM radio. Visit WeAreBroadcasters.com and tell us how you depend on AM.
And now, your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. Did you remember to brush this morning? A new survey commissioned by Listerine reveals some rather nasty information about some Americans. This poll of 2,000 adults shows the average person forgets to brush their teeth 5 times a week. 5 times a week. That's nearly half the times you're supposed to be brushing, twice a day, 7 days a week. So 5 times. How do you forget to brush your teeth? This little factoid is compounded by another gross finding from the survey. On average, we skip flossing and mouthwash 4 times a week. Now, 92% in the survey say that they do know that oral care is important to their health, and 51% said that they have had an intervention with a friend over their bad breath and or bad oral hygiene. 14% say they would even lend someone their toothbrush to rectify the situation. Well, I don't know about lend. I'd give someone a toothbrush, perhaps, but not lend. I don't want it back. Thankfully, though, 81% in the poll said they understand that visiting the dentist is important, and 75% say they brush multiple times a day. 60% use mouthwash regularly. So important. Again, the survey commissioned by Listerine, so important there. But wow, an average of 4 to 5 times a week we forget. Forget! I don't know how that happens. As is traditional, my wife Kyra has joined us in the studio for another collection of yummy and easy to make recipes from Kyra's Kitchen. Good morning.
Good morning.
Today, not a specific theme.
No.
I don't see here.
Just easy recipes.
Just a handful of recipes at random here today. Next week, you've got some easy Easter recipes with the holiday coming up.
Yep.
So we look forward to that. But today, it's just kind of a random collection of recipes, but some good ones here. You've got a recipe for mini chicken pot pies.
Yes. Okay. So this is 1 cup of cooked chicken, shredded up, 1 cup of mixed frozen vegetables thawed, 1/2 cup of cheddar cheese shredded, and 1 10.5-ounce can of condensed cream of celery soup, or whatever cream. I mean, it doesn't matter, just so it's a creamy.
Cream of celery or cream of mushroom. Or cream of whatever.
Cream of chicken.
Just one of those creamy soups.
Yes.
Okay.
One 16.3-ounce can of your refrigerated biscuits, 8-count, the bigger jumbo grand biscuits.
Okay.
So preheat your oven to 375 degrees. Coat 8 muffin pan cups with cooking spray. In a medium-sized bowl, combine your chicken, your vegetables, your cheese, and your soup until it's all mixed together. Flatten each biscuit into roughly a 4.5-inch circle using your hands. Gently press each flattened biscuit into one of the greased muffin pan pan cupcake, you know,
holes.
There you go.
Yeah.
Leave a little bit of dough in the rim around the top of each cup. Spoon your chicken mixture into each Bisquick cup. Bake for about 18 to 23 minutes or until the crust is golden brown. And it's going to be, the filling's going to be nice and bubbly. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, if you want to add a little bit more cheese to the top, Okay. You can do that.
Yeah.
And just let it melt for a few minutes and then take them out. Let them sit for 2 to 3 minutes and then serve.
Mm. Yeah. Really easy. Yes. And yummy. Who doesn't love chicken pot pies?
Yeah.
You know, you could probably do that other pot pie things as well.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah. You know, you most of the time you do chicken pot pie, mm-hmm. but you can do other pot pies as well.
Try some other different stuff. Yep.
Beef. You know, mm-hmm. whatever, sausage.
Yep. Sloppy Joe.
Mm. Oh, there you go.
Yep.
Why not?
Anything.
Give it a try.
Yes.
Get creative.
Yes.
There are no wrong answers here.
Nope.
It's like the happy little trees they paint in the paint. Yes. Bob Ross paints them. It's the Bob Ross of the kitchen.
Yes.
Also, we have a recipe for what is called hillbilly coleslaw. What makes this hillbilly coleslaw?
Because you're using like vinegar instead of your mayonnaise and all that stuff.
Okay.
So,
all right.
Yep. So, and lots of different veggies and just a mixture.
Hillbilly coleslaw.
Yes. So 2.5 pound head of green cabbage. Probably make about 6 cups once it's chopped up. And remove the core and then chop it all up. 2 cups of carrots grated, 1 small green bell pepper chopped, 1 small red onion diced, 1/2 cup of diced onion, 1 teaspoon of garlic powder, 1 teaspoon of dried celery, 1/2 teaspoon of lemon pepper, 3/4 cup of white distilled vinegar, 3/4 cup of vegetable oil, and 3/4 cups of granulated sugar. So layer your cabbage, your carrots, your green, your pepper, your red onion, and your green onion in a shallow container. Sprinkle with your garlic salt, your dried celery, and your lemon pepper in a small saucepan on the stove. Bring your vinegar, oil, and sugar to a boil. Remove from the heat and stir until sugar is dissolved. Immediately pour evenly over the vegetables, seal tightly, and chill for about 24 hours. Toss well before serving. Gets all those juices back up and around, and then it'll keep for about a week in the refrigerator, and just something to enjoy that night,
or you
could enjoy, you know, all during the week.
Yeah, so, with your mini chicken pot pie.
Yes. Yep.
The hillbilly coleslaw. And for dessert, we have a recipe for peanut butter cookie cheesecake bars.
Yeah, this...
Man, there's all kinds of really good stuff just in the title right there. Yeah. Peanut butter cookie cheesecake bars.
Yeah, this popped up on my Facebook feed, and I was like, oh, these look good. These would be awesome for Easter or for a family get-together during the summer. Take them somewhere.
No, just forget about making them for a family get-together. I want them for me.
For you, okay.
I'm not going to share these.
You're not sharing.
What are we talking about here?
So this is 1 16-ounce package of your refrigerated peanut butter cookie dough, 1 8-ounce package of cream cheese room temperature, 1/2 cup of granulated sugar, 1 teaspoon vanilla extract, 1 large egg room temperature, and 1/2 cup of Reese's Pieces. So preheat the oven to 350 degrees. Grease and then line the bottom of a 9 by 9 inch baking pan with parchment paper. Press 3/4 of the peanut butter cookie dough into the bottom of the pan for the base. In a mixing bowl, beat the cream cheese sugar with an electric mixer until smooth and well combined. Add the egg and vanilla. Beat on low until just combined. Spread the cheesecake layer over the base. Break up the remaining cookie dough into pieces, flatten them a little bit, and cover the cheesecake layer, gently pressing Reese Pieces into the top layer of the cookie dough, and bake for 30 to 35 minutes or until the cookie dough is golden brown and the cheesecake layer is set. Remove from the oven and allow to cool to room temperature for an hour, then refrigerate for at least 2 hours just to make sure it's nice and that cheesecake is nice and solid, so then you can slice it up and and enjoy. Mm-hmm. So,
that is yummy.
Yes. There.
The recipes for the mini chicken pot pies, the hillbilly coleslaw, and the peanut butter cookie cheesecake bars are all posted on the Kyra's Kitchen Facebook page at Kyra's Kitchen WFIN on Facebook. If you don't already follow the Kyra's Kitchen page, make sure that you do so, because all of the recipes are posted there. We get from time to time, folks will ask, oh, do you have that recipe, or can I get that recipe from a couple, 3 weeks ago? Yep. They're all posted on the Facebook page, so you can go back and find them all. You can also share your favorite recipe or make a request if there's something that you would like to put Kyra on the case. We'll get her looking for a good recipe for whatever that you might want.
Yes.
So you can interact there at Kyra's Kitchen WFIN on Facebook. And again, as we mentioned, next week we've got some easy Easter recipes.
Yeah. So they're not somewhat common, but not so common.
Okay.
The one are,
would these be like main dish stuff, or
or one that could be for after?
Okay.
If you want, it's a the one is a meatball recipe. So,
interesting. But,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we don't really think about meatballs for Easter, but why not?
Yeah.
Again, no rules here.
Yes.
No rules here.
Sometimes
do whatever you want.
Plain old ham is just. It's like,
happy little treats.
Yes.
Happy little meatballs.
Happy, happy.
And that's Bob Ross in the kitchen.
On this gloomy day.
There you go. So look forward to that. And until then, my wife, Kyra, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage. And that, of course, goodmornings.net. Coming up Monday morning on the program, economists warn that we are about to see the largest shift of generational wealth ever, with some $85 trillion in assets being passed down from the silent generation and baby boomers to Gen Xers and millennials. They're warning about this because many families are not prepared and are not talking about what happens with all that wealth, and that's a problem. So until Monday morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day, a great weekend. We'll catch you back here next week.